Chapter 23 Vandals. By the end of July 1997, no scientifically useful data had yet been obtained at the ranch. As a part of a switch to a more proactive and less reactive strategy, the NIDS team decided to install a number of surveillance cameras near one of the hottest spots on the ranch. A series of 6 surveillance cameras were deployed in an area several hundred feet from the command and control center. The area was chosen because a series of dramatic events had occurred nearby, including the brutal mutilation and killing of a calf a few months before, the disappearance of 6 cattle, and the observations of blue orbs and the famous orange holes over the cottonwoods. If any orange hole ever opened up in the same area of the sky, it would be captured in all its glory by the surveillance cameras. 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, the cameras silently recorded everything in the sky and on the ground of a good portion of the ranch. The cameras were standard surveillance equipment, some of which had the ability to see into the infrared. We kept hard copies of the recordings and monitored them for unusual activity. A year passed. The cameras picked up nothing unusual. Then, on July 20th, 1998, Tom Gorman noticed that 3 of the cameras had stopped recording. He walked the several hundred feet out to the telephone pole to see if a lightning strike, of which there were several that summer, had disabled the cameras. What Tom found necessitated a fast telephone call to Las Vegas. I took the call. Tom told me that somebody had badly vandalized 3 of the surveillance cameras. The wiring had been forcefully ripped out, but the 3 other cameras were still running. The call provoked a fast trip to Utah for the research team. The ranch was green, and the vegetation was especially verdant that summer. The cattle grazed as usual in the large field nearest to the homestead. As I examined the cameras on the telephone pole, it was obvious that somebody was intent on inactivating the cameras. All 3 cameras had been mounted about 15 feet off the ground, each camera facing a different direction so that the full 360 degrees could be covered. From the 3 cameras, the video feed and the power feed came together and went underground at the base of the telephone pole. All the wiring had been neatly anchored to the pole by means of PVC tubing and also by heavy-duty duct tape. Each set of wiring from individual cameras had been separately wrapped in duct tape. The PVC tubing now lay bent and twisted at the foot of the pole. All of the duct tape had been meticulously unwound from both the individual wiring and from around the telephone pole itself. Finally, the wiring itself had been dragged forcefully out of all 3 cameras. Anybody who has experience in wrapping wiring with duct tape and leaving it to bake in the summer sun will appreciate the enormous difficulty and patience required to unwind this sticky tape several times from individual wires as well as from around the pole. The marks of the duct tape on the damaged wiring as well as on the telephone pole were plainly visible. The tape was nowhere around. We searched the ground minutely for several days, for several hundreds of yards radius around the pole for the missing duct tape, but found no clues. The next part of the investigation was to see if all 3 cameras went offline simultaneously, and for this, we had to rerun the videotapes. We also hoped to obtain a clue regarding the perpetrators because it was possible the cameras might have recorded the unknown vandals during their approach to the telephone pole. The videotapes revealed that all 3 cameras had lost power almost simultaneously at about 8:30 the previous night. This was just before it had got dark, so there would have been enough light to maybe catch the perpetrators in the act of vandalism. Suddenly it dawned on us that one of the remaining 3 cameras on a separate telephone pole 200 feet away was still working. Better still, it had been pointing directly at the vandalized pole during the incident. There was a mad scramble to retrieve the videotape, and we waited in breathless anticipation as we played back the video. Sure enough, the camera had faithfully recorded everything. There was still plenty of light out as the timestamp rolled toward the fateful 8:30 time, when presumably the recording would reveal who had damaged the other cameras. We watched, dumbfounded, as the timestamp continued past 8:30 and revealed no unusual activity. Carefully, we replayed the videotape, checking to make sure we had the correct time. The videotape timestamp was precise, but we could see nothing on the footage other than the pole itself and the cattle peacefully munching grass in the pasture beyond. Each time we replayed the tape, the more certain we became that we had the correct time. This made no sense. Whoever had yanked the wiring out of the cameras should have been in plain view on the tape. Nothing, whatever, disturbed the pristine stillness. Unfortunately, the resolution was not good enough for us to see the thin wiring in any detail, but it should have afforded us a glimpse of whoever had ripped the wiring to pieces. Completely flummoxed, we took all of the videotapes back to Las Vegas in the hopes that digital enhancement might give us a clue as to what happened. After multiple rounds of digital enhancement, the puzzling incident came into even sharper focus. The resolution became good enough to see the tiny red lights on the bottom of each camera suddenly lose power at precisely 8:30 p.m., confirming that the cameras had actually lost power while being taped. Yet, the enhancement provided no clue whatsoever as to who or what had so forcefully damaged the equipment. The combination of fastidious attention to detail in removing every shred of duct tape from the wiring, while at the same time ripping out the wiring from the camera junction boxes, was disturbing. It reminded me of the same eerie combination of brute force and finesse that had been displayed in dismembering the calf a little over a year previously. And interestingly, both of these incidents had happened less than 50 yards from each other in the same field, in daylight, and in full view of witnesses in one case, and cameras in the other. The three remaining cameras on the ranch continued their surveillance. Another 8 months passed. Tom Gorman was still working as ranch manager in April 1999, hoping to get some closure on the bizarre incidents that drove him off the property. It had been 3 years since the family had vacated the property that they had once loved. He waited silently for Ellen to jump back in the pickup after she had padlocked the gate behind her. He drove slowly down the familiar track leading to what used to be his homestead. It was a bright, sunny afternoon.
"What is that?"
Ellen muttered, looking puzzled. Tom squinted west. The sun was in his eyes, but he could make out the clouds of dust coming from the corral about a quarter of a mile away. Tom kept a couple of his horses in the corral just in case he had to saddle up to retrieve any errant cattle that had broken through the fence line, an all too common occurrence in the past 3 years. The cattle had a nasty habit of stampeding en masse through the fence line. This usually meant hours of work for Tom to ride the cattle down and to herd them back onto their proper land. He had understandably grown tired of driving the 25 miles back to his place, putting the horses into the trailer, and then driving back to the ranch in order to saddle up and play cowboy. It was a lot easier simply to have a couple of horses in a corral at the ranch on standby. Tom was puzzled as he drove. He could see the horses moving quickly around the corral in the distance. Their wild kicking generated clouds of dust. The Gormans were about 300 yards away when it became obvious that the horses were not alone in the corral. Amid the clouds of dust and spooked horses, Tom could make out a reddish-brown blur that seemed to be running around the narrow space. He mentally made a note to himself to give a good thrashing to whatever dog was doing this to his horses. Panicking the horses like this might be good fun for the dogs, but it left the horses stressed for days. As they drove closer, the scene became clearer.
"That is no dog,"
Ellen said as she leaned out the open window. They were 200 yards away, and she had a much better view of the corral out of the passenger side of the pickup. She was right. Tom slowed to get a better look. Although the clouds of dust were still being kicked up, he could now see the perpetrator. It was a big animal, very heavily muscled, with short legs. It seemed to have the shape of a hyena's body, but it had a bushy tail.
"What the hell is that?" he muttered.
The creature was plainly hunting his horses, but did not seem intent on causing serious harm. It would lunge at one of the horse's legs, looking to bite it. The horse would then kick out and gallop around the corral. The animal's big, red, bushy tail reminded Tom of an exaggerated fox tail, but the rest of the body was all wrong for a fox. The animal looked and moved like a hyena, but its head more resembled a dog's. It had short, stubby legs like a boar as it made sudden rushing movements across the corral. They were 40 yards away now and dismounting from the vehicle. Tom and Ellen now had a very good look. This was like nothing they had ever seen before. It was definitely not a dog, and it was definitely not a fox, nor a hyena. Its reddish coloring was all wrong. He figured the animal weighed about 200 pounds. However, his immediate concern was for his horses. Tom slammed the pickup door and took off running. The creature suddenly stopped the hunt and turned to look at Tom as he sprinted toward the corral. Instantly, the creature took off in the opposite direction, jumped nimbly through the metal bars of the corral, and headed up a slight incline. Tom reached the side of the corral no more than 50 yards from the fleeing animal. He was determined to see where the animal was heading. It ran quickly up the slope, away from the corral, with Tom in hot pursuit. Then it was gone. Tom stopped. The creature had vanished into thin air. It was open ground. The creature was far too big to have vanished down a rabbit burrow, but Tom would have seen the large bushy tail anyway. Within a minute, he had reached the place where the animal had disappeared before his eyes. There was nothing there. The ground was too hard for tracks. Tom caught the distinctive smell of wet fur in the air. It reminded him of the rank smell of a wet dog. After searching fruitlessly for a few more minutes, Tom hurried back to his horses. Both of them had bloody hocks. They were severely scratched, but not seriously hurt. He figured the animal could have inflicted much more serious injuries on the horses if it had meant business. After 1999, there were other sightings of the large reddish hyena-like creature, once by a ranch employee and also by a local man a few miles from the ranch. In both cases, the creature fit Tom's description of the original 200-pound animal. Tom had seen other strange animals on the ranch, of course, like the large wolves, one of which was bulletproof, that had haunted the ranch for several weeks after the family had moved on to the property and then disappeared into the mists, never to be seen again. Tom also told me about some tiny, bright red birds that had suddenly appeared. For a few days, the birds, about the size of a wren, fluttered around a couple of trees near one of the abandoned homesteads and then vanished, forever. The birds' fiery red color, together with their tiny size, made them seem more like tropical birds, not indigenous to northeast Utah. Tom also told me about huge spiders he had seen in the same area around the abandoned homestead. Just like the birds, he saw the large spiders for a few weeks, then never saw them again. Other locals saw strange animals as well. In October 1998, a man and his wife were returning to their home. As they drove along the narrow roads about 3 miles from the ranch, the wife spied some movement in the field next to the roadway. It was dusk, but there was still sufficient light to make out a human-like figure running across the field. As the couple watched, the figure kept up the pace of an Olympic sprinter over hundreds of yards. They could not make out its features, but it looked like a dark, very muscled man running smoothly and effortlessly at an unbelievable speed. The creature, or man, was running in the direction of the ranch. What amazed the two witnesses was the smooth and rapid pace the running figure sustained. They watched it as it disappeared gradually from their field of view. Throughout the years, the surveillance cameras had continued recording data, and with the exception of maybe a dozen instances of fast-moving meteor-like objects and suspicious aircraft activity, possibly due to drug smuggling, we managed to obtain no sustained evidence of anomalous phenomena. We still mounted regular field trips to investigate activity on the ranch, but noted nothing of any consequence during our visits. In addition, beginning in 1999, two people began living on the old Gorman homestead, with instructions to keep eyes wide open and to report anything out of the ordinary to headquarters in Las Vegas. But the years rolled on with progressively fewer and fewer incidents. Altogether, we logged hundreds of night watches, but no sustained activity occurred with anything like the dramatic flair of the summer of 1997. By 2004, when I left NIDS, it had been several years since anything of note had happened on the property. Tom Gorman had warned NIDS, when we moved the giant observation trailer onto the property, that our approach was much too heavy-handed. The flurry of activity and the large disruption that marked our arrival seemed to be a turning point in the intensity of the activity. The NIDS team never approached the kind of stealth that Gorman had advised. Instead, Gorman frequently implied that we had acted like bulls in a china shop. We were, after all, hunting a quarry. Between August 1996, when NIDS acquired the Gorman property, and March 1997, not a great deal of activity occurred. Then, with the dismemberment of the calf, all hell had broken loose. In May 1997, a series of unexplained phenomena followed the installation of a large wire enclosure for the sentry dogs. Between June and August 1997, the phenomenon was present every time scientific personnel were. This included the sightings of balls of light in June, followed by the mysterious, apparently telepathic transmission to the physicist on the scene. During July, there were multiple sightings of balls of light and other light phenomena, all in the same area of the ranch. In August, the red ball incident occurred, and then, a few days later, that creature crawled through the hole. That incident marked the end of the period of intense activity in NID's presence. Afterward, the phenomenon became much more fleeting. Did it lose interest, or was there something now missing from the engagement? Perhaps it was the level of emotion that the Gorman family had provided in spades but was missing from the scientific team. The stress level in the family was unbelievably high. It was palpable. The Gormans did not interact with the phenomenon because they wanted to. They simply had no choice. In contrast, the NID scientific personnel were there by choice. They carried with them an attitude of cool detachment. There was almost an aggressiveness in the pursuit of the phenomenon that may have psychologically turned the tables, assuming, of course, that a consciousness was involved. At the risk of inviting strong disagreement from other NID scientists, one could ask the question, could NIDs have approached this research differently? Did our preoccupation with measurement reach a point of diminishing returns? It could be argued that our research was overly focused on one question. Is this real, or is it an artifact of A, researchers' fugue states, B, malfunctioning equipment, or C, natural causes? In short, did NIDs leave any stones unturned? Could we have more emotionally engaged the phenomenon without sacrificing scientific objectivity? Was the period from March to August 1997, during which the activity appeared to intensify dramatically, some kind of test designed to assess the scientific team? And did NIDs fail the test? Was some kind of emotional engagement expected or needed in order to deepen the dialogue? Was contact of some kind being offered? Did NID's strict adherence to scientific protocols get in the way? We may never have answers to these admittedly speculative questions.